Okay. Happy to do it. Okay, I believe that I'm ready to go. Center for Global Peace Journalism. Good morning. Accident would be one characterization. Serendipity would be another. I was on a Fulbright scholarship in Azerbaijan in 2007, and I got a call from the U.S. Embassy, and they said, "Would you be interested in teaching a peace journalism seminar in the Republic of Georgia?" And the Republic of Georgia is next door to Azerbaijan. And of course, I said, "Well, I'm an expert on peace journalism. I'd be happy to do that." And then the moment that I hung up with the embassy, I decided that I better Google peace journalism since I had no idea what it was. I thought, well, that kind of sounds interesting. And I really wanted to go to Georgia. And my instincts on that were absolutely correct. What a beautiful country, really good food, and the wine's not too bad either. Well, they're like many social science sorts of terms, there's more than one definition. The one that I like to use talks about that peace journalism is when reporters and editors make choices that can create an atmosphere that's conducive to peace. So when we define peace journalism, it's almost easier to talk about the opposite. And the opposite is simply the traditional journalism that sensationalizes violence, that incites conflict and violence, and that doesn't consider the consequences of its own reporting. And so peace journalism seeks to counter those things. Well, I would say this, that for the most part, that peace journalists are reporting on the same things that mainstream journalists are reporting on. So it's not that we're ignoring violence or ignoring conflict. More often than not, it's about the way that we report that. So do we report it in such a way that it exacerbates conflict, that it inflames violence, or do we report it in such a way that it does not, and as far as what we're reporting that others might not report, I would say that that might fall in the category of giving peacemakers a voice, or at least a proportional voice to those who are advocating conflict. I think it also means giving a voice to the voiceless, because marginalized people, as we know, as social science tells us, that marginalized people are more likely to strike out, to behave violently, and so on. So those are the things that peace journalism seeks to do. Well, I think not only is it implied, I think that there's a body of research that supports that that supposition that indeed the traditional journalism as a group, as a category, the traditional journalists don't tend to consider the consequences of their reporting. And what peace journalists are always looking at is, okay, if I report this story in this way, what are the consequences? And certainly, if we look back at history, we see many, many examples of the consequences of traditional reporting or even war journalism being very grave indeed about the way that radio has incited violence, incited the helping to incite and to inflame the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, for example, or in 2007, 2008 in Kenya, where 800 people were killed. In Uganda in 2009. And of course, there are examples of irresponsible sorts of war journalism here in the United States as well. Just in the last week, I've read half a dozen articles maybe about the I don't know if irresponsible is the right word, but about how the American press as a group dropped the ball in the run-up to the Iraq War, and how they're simply parroting the Bush administration's propaganda, how that helped to subsequently lead us into a war that we discovered, many of us believe was unjustified. It's absolutely. It's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. If you Google, if you go into Google, actually, shortly after the war began, the New York Times ran what amounts to an apology letter for not being as diligent as they should have been in checking out and attempting to verify what the Bush administration was telling us. So we know what they were telling us. They were telling us that there were weapons of mass destruction. We know that those were phantoms. They were telling us that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. Well, we know from the 9/11 Commission report, and even at the time, we knew better that Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11. And so we as the American public were, my opinion now, sold a bill of goods on this war. And I think the press was, at least to an extent, complicit in this. Now, that's not to say that there wasn't some reporting, that shed some light on this. But typically, and I just read an analysis about Washington Post reporting, there was a lot of that reporting on the Washington Post, but that reporting tended to be buried, that the sort of pro-war propaganda was on page one, and these sorts of reports that questioned the administration tended to be on page 10 or 20 or 30. Well, simply, I believe what they're talking about is that when all we do is to parrot official propaganda, government propaganda, that what we do is we create this feedback loop. So we parrot government propaganda about, oh, how dangerous Saddam Hussein is, and what we tend to hear back from others is a repetition of that. Oh, Saddam Hussein must be really dangerous. And then you have the government saying, oh, yes, Saddam Hussein is dangerous. See, the people recognize this. I think that maybe the best example of this was an item that the administration, the White House, planted in the New York Times. The item that some of our listeners may remember, the item was about these aluminum tubes that were supposedly used to make nuclear weapons. Well, they weren't. But at any rate, this false item was planted in the New York Times, and then a day or two later on one of the Sunday talk shows, there was Dick Cheney saying, well, now you have these reports in the mainstream media. It's very clear to see that there are these weapons of mass destruction. So he's citing the source that they planted to justify the action in Iraq. And this is a perfect example, I believe, of this feedback loop. Well, I think some of it is habit. Some of it is the prevailing thought in the media that what we do has to be sensational, that spicing things up and making them sensational sells more papers and gets higher ratings for broadcasts. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I think that's part of the reason. I think part of the reason is laziness, that it's easier simply to report that kind of propaganda. Part of it, too, is that newsrooms these days have fewer and fewer resources. And so the resources, the ability of a Woodward and Bernstein to go out and spend months and months and months reporting these things, well, that's not going to happen much anymore. And it's because newsrooms are smaller and smaller and smaller. I know my local newspaper here, the Kansas City Star, its newsroom is half the size that it was just a few years ago. So this limits the kind of enterprise reporting that I think reporters really need to do to fulfill their watchdog function. And I think that's part of it too. It's a lot more, it's a lot easier story to tell, and it's a lot more compelling story. The U.S., Bush versus Saddam. That was even a Newsweek headline. Bush versus Saddam, who will win? Well, if there's ever been an oversimplification, that's it, right? It's taking something that's multifaceted and complex and boiling it down to something that a fifth grader could understand. Well, I hope that peace journalists aren't inspired by the Iraq example, by the examples in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere, that we're inspired to take a look at the consequences of our reporting. So when we report, what's the effect of that report? The example I always use when I'm in Africa is, are we pouring gasoline on the fire? So we know that there are conflicts. We know that sometimes they're violent. But are we making a violent situation worse? Here in the U.S., it's not as often a matter of life and death, but it is a matter, it is a serious matter as well. So I recently wrote a piece about should the media broadcast the Sandy Hook conspiracies? So as you've probably heard, there are those who are saying, well, that the Sandy Hook shootings didn't really occur, that it was all staged by the government. And so several months ago, CNN ran some pieces on this. So what I wrote was, what are the consequences of this report? When CNN ran these reports, did they sit down and consider these consequences? I hope that they did. I don't necessarily agree with their decision to do it, but I'm hoping that it was at least thoughtful. So when you broadcast, for example, these conspiracy theories, so what are you doing? Well, in my view, you're giving the conspiracy theorists exactly what they want. You're giving them publicity. That by broadcasting something like that on CNN, that even if the report is critical, that still merely by broadcasting it, you're giving it some legitimacy that it otherwise wouldn't have. And then finally, and the culminating point of my article was very simply that I think when you report something like this, that you run the very real risk of re-victimizing the families. So if I was a family member, and I think these conspiracy theories would just infuriate me. And so was that considered? I would hope that as peace journalists that we would look at, we would examine what we do in a thoughtful way before we do it and always consider the consequences. Well, you know, as far as making the problem worse, I don't know that. Yeah, I guess what I would say is this. I think that a lot of times that mainstream reporting of conflict tends to present violence and war as the only option or as the most viable option. And I think that was the case in the run-up to the Iraq War. I think it's, as we're considering now, I think more and more support for Syria, you know, is violence the only alternative that's being presented? Now, I'm not saying that as peace journalists it's our job to prevent war, but I do think it's our job to be thorough in presenting the public a buffet of options, what we should be considering. And certainly that didn't happen in Iraq. And one might argue as well that that didn't happen in the run-up to our intervention in Libya. Not that the Libyan intervention was necessarily a bad thing, but I think in a democratic society that citizens need to be fully armed with all the information from all the sides so that they can make informed choices about whether a violent conflict is what we want. That's very well said. I think that one of the tenets of peace journalism is that peace journalism is proactive. Peace journalism is looking for solutions. So as a peace journalist, if I'm in Kenya, for example, and I'm looking ahead to an election when the last election was tremendously violent, I'm being proactive in asking myself, how can my reporting help to create an atmosphere where peace is possible? And I think if you look at the very recent Kenyan election that was just held, that sort of peace journalism and peace reporting occurred in Kenya. So rather than just sitting back and waiting for violence to happen, I think that peace journalists are digging deeper and looking at systemic causes and looking to address those, or at least to air those grievances. Because as we know, many times it's simply airing and discussing grievances can be very cathartic and can help to let off the steam that otherwise might lead to violence. That's my own insanity, by the way. If that wasn't clear, yes. So the insanity is not the Ugandans. The insanity is me. Well, the takeaways are different depending on where I am. So, for example, the two most recent series of workshops, one was in the Bronx, New York, and I was working with an organization called BronxNet and with Lehman College there, working with students and with public access producers. And the takeaway there was very simply that they have a working knowledge of peace journalism and that they're able to understand how peace journalism applies to the kinds of reporting that they do day to day. So in the New York and the Bronx seminars, we talk a lot about actually peace journalism and crime and how crime reporting is like the sort of traditional war reporting that's memorialized in the literature about peace journalism, it's very analogous. And so we talk about a lot of those things in New York City. Now, I'll be returning there in June to teach what we're calling a peace journalism boot camp. The most recent project in Uganda, and I just got back about a week ago, is called Peace Media and Counterterrorism. And this is a little bit different take on peace journalism. The idea here is that we've gotten together journalists with security officials, with army, police, and so on, those in charge of security in Uganda. And we've put them together in the same room. The very fact that they sit in the same room for 3 days and not kill each other is a very good thing. I don't literally mean kill each other, but it's a very strained relationship between these security officials and the media, probably even more so than it is in the United States. And the idea is to get them to recognize that they have, although they have many conflicting interests, that they have some common interests, some common purposes, and that their interest is in keeping Uganda safe from terrorism. So the idea, the notion of this is that media people and security people can work together to create messages like public service announcements and stories and so on, can create messages that can help keep the Ugandan public vigilant and safe against terrorism. And that project actually just concluded last week. And, we're crunching some numbers now, but I'm pretty confident that we met our goals. I got a lot of positive feedback about how they're talking to each other now. They're not best friends holding hands and singing Kumbaya, but certainly the lines of communication are now open. And that was the overall goal of that Uganda project. Certainly. And one of the things that we talk about at length is that each group is still going to have their own agenda. So as journalists, this doesn't mean that we're abandoning our watchdog role. It doesn't mean that when the security screw up, that we're not there to call them on it. As security people, this doesn't mean that we'll be releasing information that can compromise security, that can jeopardize investigations, and so on. So, I mean, each side still has their own role, their own agenda, but somewhere in the middle is this area where they can agree, and they can agree that they want to keep Uganda safe, and they can agree that if they work together in these public information campaigns, that they can help to accomplish that goal. That's exactly right. So it behooves both sides to tap into the expertise of the other. And this was a message that I hope came through loud and clear to our Ugandan participants. So my book is called Professor Komagum. And as you said, Komagum is a name that was given to me. So one of the many languages that's spoken in Uganda is called Acholi. So after a seminar in 2009 in Gulu, which is in northern Uganda in Acholi land, one of the participants said, "We've decided to give you the Acholi name Komagum, which means lucky, because we feel lucky to have been in this seminar." And so the name, at least when I'm in Gulu, is sort of stuck. And of course, I was very flattered by that. How did I end up in Uganda? Well, it was like, as you read the book, you'll see that I am, that I wish I could tell you that I have this brilliant master plan that I've executed. And more often than not, I've sort of stumbled into things. And that's how it happened in 2009 in Uganda. I had known that I'd wanted to go to Africa and do this kind of work, and I had a colleague who worked at the U.S. Embassy in Kampala at the time, and she and I had talked about this, and it was through her intervention and good graces that I was able to go to Uganda for about 6 weeks in the summer of 2009. And then everywhere I went in 2009 in Uganda, I heard over and over again how how important the peace journalism work is, but how there needed to be much more, particularly with the 2011 elections coming up in Uganda. So they really felt like there needed to be a comprehensive program that centered on peace and electoral journalism. And so that's how the larger project came about. The larger project starting in 2010, ending in 2011. It's about an 11-month project with a $250,000 State Department grant. And that was, and during that period, I was on sabbatical from my university and lived and worked in Uganda. Well, I mean, I guess I would say this, that Uganda is, I would call it a recovering nation. So there was an awful 20-year civil war fought against the Lord's Resistance Army, which most Americans now associate with the film Kony 2012. And we could talk about that all day. So although the film was flawed, I will say that at least it built some awareness. So this was a country that's had, you know, a history of violence. So yeah, Idi Amin was the president during the 70s. I still get asked all the time, well, what's Idi Amin doing? And it would be like asking an American, well, how's President Carter? Because their tenures overlapped. So Idi Amin is dead. But when he was alive, he was certainly not working for peace like President Carter. Absolutely not. Actually lived an exiled life of luxury in Saudi Arabia. We can talk about that as well. But at any rate, so Uganda is a country with a troubled history. Now, the president, whose name is Museveni, has been president since 1986, has been reelected repeatedly. And if you could see me, I'm doing reelected with air quotes. The elections are varyingly free, somewhat democratic, but certainly not up to a Western European, for example, a Western European standard. I would say at this point that the country is fairly stable, that that the government you know, is in control, obviously, of all the parts of the country, that as that there are a number of developmental problems, of course, but I think in some instances that Uganda is making strides. It was one of the, it had one of the best first responses to the HIV, for example, assisted by the United States, I might add. So it responded pretty well to that, but there's still a number of challenges, obviously. Well, I'll preface those comments by saying that these sorts of personal interventions as a journalist always trouble me. And perhaps it's because of my very traditional journalism upbringing. I can still see my grizzled old journalism professors wagging their gnarly fingers at me and saying, you know, a journalist never gets involved with the story. And I think that fundamentally that makes a lot of sense to me. But you know, when you're in the field, it doesn't make quite as much sense. And the example that the book begins with is the story of a young woman who attended one of my workshops in Fort Portal in far western Uganda. And she heard me talk about giving a voice to the voiceless, which I emphasize in the seminars. And so after the seminar was through, she decided that she wanted to do one of these Voice of the Voiceless stories. So what she did was go out and find a story and tell the story of six orphans. And it's the worst imaginable story. You couldn't make up something this horrible. So what had happened was that the father was an alcoholic, and the father killed the mother, and then the father killed himself. And these children are left by themselves in literally in the middle of nowhere. And I know because I've been there. And so they somehow managed to stay alive for 13 months, stealing food, suffering through some medical issues until Betty, that's the reporter's name, until Betty told their story on the air. And as soon as she told their story, there was an outpouring of support, food, free medical care, clothes, and so on. But the kids still didn't have a place to live. And so Betty and her mother, who lived together, decided that they would take in the kids. These are six kids at the time, ages 5 through 14. So she took these kids in. And her story is so incredible that it's a story that I use in every seminar, every workshop. I've told the story 1,000 times because I'm so taken with it. Now, my very small part of this is that once the kids were living with Betty, everything was fine except that the kids weren't going to school. Now, in Africa, as in much of the developing world, elementary and secondary education is not free. You have to pay school fees. Well, Betty couldn't afford to pay these school fees. So somebody had to do it. And if it wasn't me, if you would have been there, Paul, or I think if, you know, 99% of us would have been there and said, well, these kids can't go to school, you know, without even thinking about it, you just blurt out, well, I'll pay for them to go to school. I mean, it's not as magnanimous as it might sound. To me, it just seemed like a very practical matter. Only later did I think, well, I'm going to tell this story, and now I'm a part of this story. And I'll admit that that makes me uncomfortable, but it doesn't make me as uncomfortable as not helping those kids would have made me. So well, I wouldn't say report, but I will say that they had for a time that the kids did a Saturday morning broadcast with Betty, where they talked about children's issues, they talked about orphans and so on. So I wouldn't call it reporting exactly, but the kids actually became sort of minor celebrities in Fort Portal. So I thought that was interesting too. And Betty said she did that it really gave the kids, she thought, a chance to talk about what they'd been through, and she thought it was you know, good for them psychologically. And I agree. I just saw the oldest of the kids is named Annette. She's 17 years old now, and she has a couple more years of secondary school, but she's just doing great. She's all grown up now, and in the book it says that she wanted to be a doctor, but as of last week, she told me she wants to be an accountant, and I told her that that's a fine choice too, and maybe she can start helping me with my accounting. Well, I mean, I think that's true too. The question is how a traditionalist might say that the difference is that in the instance where the media presence makes a difference, that there's no intent to make a difference. I mean, that's what the traditionalists would say, that they were just there reporting and, oh, by the way, this happened. I think a peace journalist would look at that claim rather skeptically. Certainly what I did, and I really shouldn't say I, because our friends and family are really chipping in and helping to pay these school fees for these kids. So it's a lot more than just me. But at any rate, you know, what we're doing is a much more thoughtful, deliberate act. Now, whether that, what that says about my ethics as a journalist is certainly open to discussion and interpretation. I know in my peace journalism class here at Park University, it's one of the first things that we talk about. And I think it probably makes the students a little uncomfortable. Is your professor unethical? But I'm certainly willing to discuss that. And I know that there are traditional journalists who would say, you know, you're not a journalist, that you're just a tarted up social worker. And I'm willing to accept that criticism. Well, I wouldn't disagree with you, but I think the traditionalists would. The traditionalists would say, when you give that $20 bill or that morsel of food, that you're inserting yourself into the story and that you've lost your objectivity. I don't. Ah, see, therein lies the rub, doesn't it? So one of the things we talk about in peace journalism class, and my contention is that there's no such thing as objectivity. Yes, I think that it's a laudable goal that we should strive to be as objective as we can when we're reporting. But I think that there are times, for me at least, there have been times where what I consider to be my ethical responsibilities have been that my ethical responsibilities have overshadowed what I would consider to be my journalistic responsibilities. Well, there are many such examples. The work that we've done in Uganda succeeded. The 2010-2011 project, the goal was no media-induced or exacerbated violence around the time of the election. And that's exactly what happened. We did a comprehensive survey to see if our project was responsible for that. That survey is delineated in the appendix of my book. And indeed, the project succeeded in doing that. There have been a number of peace journalism projects in the Philippines. I know that that have achieved some level of measurable success. I know from an academic standpoint that a study done by the father of peace journalism, his name is Jake Lynch. He's a professor at the University of Sydney, that he did a study recently where he went to three different countries, Mexico, the Philippines, and a third country that I can't think of right now. But anyway, Professor Lynch went to three countries, and what he did is he showed focus groups two different television stories. So one story was sort of a traditional war-type journalism, and the second was the same story framed as peace journalism, told in a different way. And the results that he found were consistent with all three countries, and that is that audiences really, that the peace journalism approach really does have an impact on audiences. That when audiences see the traditional war reporting, their feelings about the story, they tend to think that it's hopeless, that there's no alternative but a violent alternative, that peace is not possible. But when you take the same story and frame it as peace journalism, they tend to be a lot more hopeful about the way that the conflict, they tend to be a lot more hopeful that the conflict can be resolved in a non-violent way. They tend to be a lot more hopeful and a lot more informed about options other than violent options to solving the conflict. So I think that there's both practical applications and research that have proven that this peace journalism approach is a good one. Yeah, sure. So both in the Jake Lynch example and traditional stories. So a traditional war sort of story is sensationalized. The violence is glamorized. The wording is very inflammatory and emotive. So we have brutal massacres, we have bloody, we have all the use of that kind of language. We have peacemakers not given a voice. We have government propaganda presented as facts, and so on. So with peace journalism, you don't use that kind of inflammatory language. The violence is mentioned in the peace journalism story, but it's not highlighted. It's not sensationalized. And yes, you present many options in a peace journalism story, options about the way that the conflict can be resolved, rather than just parroting government propaganda that we have to go in and attack these people, smash these people, neutralize them. So rather than that sort of thing, you have others who are proposing nonviolent alternatives. So those would be the two, that would be the main differences between the two. Absolutely, and that's what the research would show from Professor Lynch, and anecdotally, that was the experience that we had in Uganda and the recent experience in Kenya as well. Thank you. No, it's been pretty thorough. So peace journalism is not activist journalism, is not advocacy journalism. Indeed, I would say that peace journalism is simply good journalism. So we're not advocating for peace. We are simply presenting to the audience peace as an option. Yes, we still present the violent options. We're still presenting the government propaganda, but we're simply going beyond that. And we're saying, here are some other alternatives. So peace journalists do not openly advocate for peace. What peace journalists do is present peace as an alternative. No, sir, I appreciate your time and the interview. And anyone who's interested in exploring some more about this can find my book, Professor Komagum, K-O-M-A-G-U-M, at Amazon.com. Or if you're interested in exploring peace journalism further, you can go to the website for the Center for Global Peace Journalism. It's at park.edu/peacecenter, all one word, lowercase. Thank you for your time. Thank you, sir.